Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single fantasy book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. Joining me, like normal, like always, let's say, is Juliana.
Hello, everyone.
And today we are wrapping up our journey through The Lord of the Rings.
The epic
podcast sequence where we've done The Silmarillion. We've talked about Lord of the Rings in some of the movie stuff. We've talked about our views on the movies. Yeah, it all comes back to last year. I actually listened to a podcast from the podcast Cortex podcast, which is with a guy called Mike and CGP Grey. And if you know CGP Grey, you'll know him from his fast-talking YouTube deep dive into random topics and things like that.
So, yeah, he does lots of fun videos on YouTube.
Years ago, he did some stuff about Lord of the Rings. So he's been into Lord of the Rings. It's good, some good, fun, quick explainer kind of stuff. Anyway, Mike had never watched Lord of the Rings, the movies. And so they watched it and did one podcast per episode in their specials feed or, you know, the one that you pay for.
Yeah.
And every month I generally give between 5 and 8 euros to a different podcast that I listen to. To get access to the last year of their, you know, bonus content.
And back catalogue and
back
whatever.
Catalogue, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that's what I did last year with the Cortex podcast. Listen to their bonus episodes. And yeah,
nice.
Really enjoyed the experience of hearing somebody who loves the books and knows the movies really well.
Mm-hmm.
And has watched all the making of documentaries and stuff like that. And then somebody else who hasn't watched the movies, watching them for the first time and kind of like getting into it.
Yeah.
And I thought that's what me and Juliana should do at Christmas as our Christmas movie marathon thing.
Yeah, it kind of played out, like, but also not quite played out. Like,
well, here's the thing. We forgot to record the podcast as we went along. And at the end of it, I was like, well, I don't have that much to say about the movies, you know, because... Yeah. While I think they are interesting, I think I would regret spending a lot of time talking just about the movies because I think it's been done too much. You know, it's like that when the first Star Wars movie came out, you know, the first like sequel, you know, what is it? The Force Awakens came out.
Yeah.
We did a big, long podcast about
it. We did.
And I kind of regret doing that because what we should have done is given like a 20-minute or 5-minute or 10-minute, like just sort of like checking in, because I'm never going to go back and listen to that podcast. And I can't believe anybody would ever listen back to that podcast of us talking about a movie where I was like, well, the first half was really good and then Han Solo turned up and it was dumb.
Yeah, but also it was kind of like, because it was the first big sequel,
it
felt meaningful at the time.
And that's the thing, like a lot of these things feel meaningful at the time, but now we're at the 20 years later. It's not like, oh, I've got something meaningful and insightful to say now about this movie. It's more like retrospective or like what movie making was like 20 years ago and how, you know, you're seeing the impact of The Lord of the Rings on following movies and things. That's the level that we were talking about. But again, I'm not going to say anything new that nobody else has said before.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I was like, then, hey, let's reread Lord of the Rings and approach talk about Lord of the Rings, not always through the glowing eye of Peter Jackson creative decisions and rewriting things.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And so this is why I started The Lord of the Rings, the novel.
And the Silmarillion.
Paused Fellowship of the Rings, read the Silmarillion, listened to it all by Andy Serkis, who is a very good audiobook narrator.
But you shouldn't sing.
He should not sing. And then carrying on and finishing up. And I was like, oh, maybe I should go back and maybe I should re-listen to The Hobbit again. But I think I've done it kind of slightly out of order.
Yeah.
And I kind of enjoy this way around because I've got a bit much better view into what, first of all, the Silmarillion is that I'd never read before. And then my second ever read through of Lord of the Rings has been, through the lens of the movies, but also through the lens of the Silmarillion. And there's a lot more going on in the book than you would think, given even the epic moviness.
Mm.
Because...
I mean, they had to cut out things. They were already really detailed in the movies, but it already is a massive, long, epic movie quest. And then you had this the base book, the book that it, or like the
books, there's so much action,
so
in there.
Much that you could, like, you had to cut stuff out.
Yeah.
That then the general audience who only approached Lord of the Rings via the movies, they don't know.
Yeah. The story is about.
Yeah.
What the book is about. And here's the thing. So this case, in terms of these podcasts, instead of always going through via what the movie is or what the battles are, even what the characters are, I kind of worked out what I wanted to talk about in terms of like each book within The Lord of the Rings, which is not the Fellowship of the Rings, the Two Towers and The Lord of the Rings. It's sort of like book one, The Ring Sets Out. Book two, The Ring Heads South, you know, that kind of thing. So those individual books, those ones are each about a thing. And I'll just go through it now because I thought it was an interesting framework to talk about. The book one is all about hobbits, concerning hobbits.
Yeah.
Book two, you find a lot more about the elves. Book three, it's much more about the wizards. Mm. You know, it's Saruman and Gandalf and a bit of Ents and things. But, you know, sort of like these longer, like more powerful things than even the elves.
Mm.
Book four is much more about Gollum and the ring's power and how it tempts things, you know, because you see the impact that it's made on Gollum.
Yeah, and like then long-term impact.
Yeah, and you also kind of meet other people who are tempted by it as well, Faramir, etc. And then book five is about men, more specifically kings, and book six is about hobbits again, because there it's about saying goodbye and getting, you know, them dropping the rings off. So today I want to talk in this episode a bit more about men and hobbits again.
Mm.
And that's going to be, then I will wrap up the entire reading experience and give my final review of the book itself.
Awesome.
Juliana wanted this episode to be a bit shorter, so I didn't add any notes. But here's my problem is when I make more notes, sometimes the podcast is shorter because it's more focused. And here I didn't make any more notes except from the time that I was reading it.
Okay. Well, let's see.
So
if it keeps going,
did add one note. Beforehand, I was talking about this Meal of Thorns podcast that I'd listened to.
Yeah.
After I'd already decided to read, between the time of me starting my Lord of the Rings journey and reading the Silmarillion and all that kind of stuff, they released the podcast Meal of Thorns released an episode about the Silmarillion, which I listened to after reading The Silmarillion and reviewing it, but then that is kind of informed this sequence. You know, I've taken some of the what do they call them? The talking points, you know, they're what they thought, like what even are elves and talking about battles and things like that.
Right.
And I kept on saying, oh, the host, and couldn't remember it, but I made a note. The host is Jake Casella Brookins, and the guest on that podcast was a guy called Eden Coopermintz.
Good names.
Good name. Eden Coopermintz is German.
Also good. Like, just overall, good sounding names.
Good sounding names. Yeah. Anyway, fun episodes. If you want something a lot shorter than that, we recorded and actually edited, maybe? I'm not sure. So I thought I'd just mention that because for the past two episodes, I've been saying the guys and I can't remember what the names were and I didn't make a note. I made a note and read it out. So anyway, let's move on to book five, Men. And
kings.
And kings? Kings specifically, but men, but also what makes someone a good man, but then also the opposite of men.
Hmm.
So this whole section of the book is very, very clear that what makes you a great man is, of course, having a bit of elf blood in you. But
great.
The most important thing...
Things you can't have a say on.
Even if you can't control the thing that you have, you know, you can't control your genetics. If we just use the term genetic, even though in the book it's very much not genetics.
Yes.
It's like another kind of thing that goes off to the side.
Mm.
But you totally see why, you know, there's a whole like muggles and not muggles and wizards, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's the whole idea of someone having like someone highborn or born into something, or there's something about them that they can't control, but you know, you just discover that, you know, you're the kid who lives in the woodshed, and then you turn out, oh yeah, your great 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 grandfather was a king, and you've got a bit of that in you, and you're the next in line,
and you were dropped off away from all the powerful things so that they don't know you exist or whatever.
And there's, you know, it goes like back to Arthurian legends, sort of like someone has something in them that they can pull the sword from the stone, and what makes them special, and there is that here. But actually, the message of the book is that that's all useless unless you are a good friend to people.
Mm.
And Aragorn, our main, you know, in the movie, who becomes like the main protagonist, and it's all about his personal journey.
Yeah,
In the novel, it's not about his personal journey of like, yes, I will, you know, that kind of, you know, the what is it, the hero with a thousand faces or whatever the whole thing is, like the monomyth of someone who goes, here's a thing, I can do it, no, I can't do it, yes, I will do it, you know, there's all this kind of like coming out. None of that. He doesn't have a hero's journey.
Okay.
All his job is to be so good and to be like so kingly and be so manly and to be so like great that people just want to hang out with him. And yeah. So much of this book, especially of this, like these sections where you meet, you know, the Theoden, the king, and these other guys, and Éomer, is all about building relationships and building friendships and wanting to work together.
Yeah.
It's like this whole idea of sort of like, oh yeah, you're going to be the king, but the reason why people come to your aid, people come to the aid of Gondor, isn't because you're great or you've got some elf blood in you. It's because you're actually a great guy and people want to be your friend.
Yes.
And so much of this book is about, you know, the fellowship is friendship. It's sort of like, oh, yeah, there's, you know, over there you've got Gimli and Legolas, and they become really good friends. Stop smirking.
You are doing the smirking.
I'm saying
here.
The book itself explains that no dwarf and elf have ever been greater friends than Legolas and Gimli.
Yeah, it's and great. It's a great friendship.
The friendship of the hobbits as well. But really, this is reflecting that to be a great leader, the people who you're with, you can't be their superior. You have to be their friends.
Yeah.
And if you're a king, the other kings around you have to be, I know, it's just friendship is the thing that brings people over, you know.
Yeah.
And
also what I like about what you just said is this wanting to work together. There is, and I just, that's one of those experiences in my life, is that if you want to work together, like if everybody has actually the desire to make something work, it doesn't matter if you disagree on some certain things or so. But if your like main desire is to actually make something work, you will find ways to work together.
Or it can be done.
Yes.
Yeah, it can be done.
Yes. And, so I think that's a really good insight.
And in the movie, it really isn't that. You know, there isn't much of that. It's much more about, oh, yeah, if this guy can just, like, accept that he should be the king. But, like, it doesn't make any... Like, in the movie, it kind of makes sense that he... But, like, what is it about Aragorn who makes him into a great leader?
Yeah, I think in the movies, it was very much about this typical, and we have seen it in other movies, this typical, the burden of responsibility that has come to you via your born, whatever. And that is kind of what they concentrated on.
Yeah.
So
because they,
not so much
in the movie, they spent so much time on battles that they couldn't just have like all of the fun stuff that they had in the Fellowship of the Rings, where you see, you know, the interaction between them and you see that like Gimli and Legolas are like, you know, nobody throws the dwarf, and then in the second movie they're like, all right, throw the dwarf, and they have like the head count competition.
Yeah.
All of that is friendship building.
Yes.
And the hobbits, like I say, all of the stuff in the first book is all about the friendship between the hobbits. It's all like, oh yeah, you haven't been talking to us about this, but we're friends with you, so our friendship is so deep that we can, you know, we build it up again. And in the next book as well, in book 6, which is I think it's called like Many Goodbyes or whatever. Oh no, that was a chapter. Anyway, the whole point when it's all about then Frodo and Sam, again, that's all about the friendship there, that they're like, no two hobbits have ever loved each other as much as Frodo and Sam.
Yeah.
And it's just like just that the friendship of I'll do anything for you, you'll do anything for me. Again, that's more of hobbit style friendship. But in book 5, where it's all the Battle of Pelennor Fields and, you know, over here and going over there, the key part of that is friendship. It's also about kindness, and this is it's a strange thing that it's almost impossible to put into a movie, that people being kind is like the key part of it.
Yeah.
Now, this bumps up quite a lot about against the colonialism in the Lord of the Rings, in that there were these Numenoreans, the kings who had the most elf blood in them.
Oh,
who
yeah,
were,
yeah.
Back in the day, right. There was two brothers who were half elf and half human man, and they they were given the thing, like, you can't be half and half, you have to choose one. You either choose immortality or you choose mortality. So you either choose to be an elf or you choose to be a man. And one of them choose to be an elf, and the other one, that's what do you call it, Council of Elrond. Elrond was a half elf, and he chose to be an elf.
Yeah.
And his brother chose to be a man, and then all of his descendants had, you know, elf blood in them and became the kings of the human area of the men of the, you know, the Middle Earth and the West there. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of it. But those people would move around and they'd be like, all right, we're going to give you these. And they say to the Rohan people, the Riders of Rohan, who were these northern tribes, northern steppe tribes, are like, all right, we're going to give you this land.
Yeah.
And we find out in the Fellowship of the Rings, no, sorry, in the Two Towers, that that land belonged to some people. Yeah. There was like natives, indigenous people who lived there.
Yeah.
And they were just like kicked off, and they were like forced back off of these grass, you know, grasslands and off the steppes and stuff. And they were forced up into the hills. Mm. And then in the Helm's Deep battle in the movie, they were just like, oh yeah, it's just orcs and Uruk-hai. That's all that they're only fighting against, orcs and Uruk-hai.
Yeah.
In the book, it's quite clear that a big part of the attacking army are the hill people who were driven off their land 600 years ago or 1,000 years ago, when the Rohan, the riders, the Rohan people were given that land.
Mm.
And that, you know, Helm's Deep is a symbol of that used to, you know, that was left over from the Gondor people who had claimed the land. So the indigenous people come down and fight with the orcs and the Uruk-hai against our heroes. Now, that would be important. Like, you can't put that in the movie.
Yeah.
But in the book, it's really important that all of the orcs are killed. Every single orc, which is sort of like a Sauron, you know, evil twist,
creature,
you know,
yeah.
something that's going against nature.
Yeah.
They're either killed or driven into the forest and swallowed up and killed by the trees. Mm. But on all the humans who are left over in the battle, the defeated humans are told, all right, you were deceived. Saruman deceived you. You made a big mistake here.
Mm.
Go back and keep living your life. And it's like just forgiveness there.
Yeah. Okay.
And in the same thing in the big battles of Pelennor Fields, again, in the movie, it's just, you know, Oliphants and stuff. Mm. And then there's sort of like, it's referenced like, oh, some people, like humans, but they make sure that all the humans have masks so you can't see that the southern people and the eastern people,
yeah.
You know, these hordes coming over, you know, and this is now a big battle around Constantinople or whatever it's meant to be, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
This is sort of like some big Byzantine battle. There's big walls and there's battles going out here, and then the boats come up the Golden Horn, and, you know, it's trying to have a big battle of sort of like, you know, this clash of civilizations or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And there's lots of humans there. And in the movie, they're like, and then we defeat them. And then we're like, oh, right, so what about, like, sure, you defeated the orcs and the trolls that came in, but you've got all the people who came up on the boats, on the corsairs, and the people who came on the elephants. They were all humans. They're men.
Yeah.
What do you do about that? And in the movie, they're like, and we kill them all and move on. And in the book, it's a lot clearer. Like, no, you were deceived. You know, the Sauron over there is this deceptive force.
Yeah.
And in the book, again, this was written in, you know, from 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. And it feels very like Marshall Plan rather than Treaty of Versailles style of, all right, all of this happened here, but what we need to do is put this back to, you know, we need to put this all back together in a way where we need to forgive people for fighting against us and try and, you know, we can have our Nuremberg trials and make sure that this person doesn't become too, but or whatever it's going to be.
Yeah.
But it feels very much more, I don't know, kindness and forgiveness.
Yeah.
Even when, if there's no friendship there, friendship can be developed with kindness and forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. I always think that these, especially in movies and especially in epics like that, the complexity of the issues often are cut short due to no time, and it's already taking too long. And in a book like The Lord of the Rings, and I haven't read this now, I think what it often comes down to is that certain factions come together.
Yeah.
And then it is like, oh, this is the enemy of my enemy becomes then my friend,
yeah,
because we can then fight together, yeah, because we have beef with them for various reasons. Yeah. And then, oh, okay, if we just now team up together against this faction of people,
yeah,
we can get our revenge and stuff.
Yeah.
And I totally understand all of the behavior of humans in this respect, because it is cruel and like long-term family trauma kind of stuff. And then in the end, it can sometimes then become a bit too like, oh yeah, let's just forgive each other. And from then on, we move forward in peace. This is the best solution. Of course, it needs to happen at some point. Otherwise, it's just always going to be revenges and whatever, people being upset for what other people did in the past to their families and stuff. And I totally understand. It is so complex.
Yeah.
And it is so difficult to get down to, okay, what do we do about it?
I think in the book, a lot of these things are just sort of like one sentence in a longer paragraph.
Okay.
But it reflects on, I don't know, it just shows a reflection which is missing from, again, the movies, but also missing from a lot of fantasy and other kind of stuff, is that everyone on the other side has got reasons for it. And
yes.
And then there's the... What was it going to say? Also, the part of it is sort of like, oh yeah, stop coming in here and killing us, say the Neanderthals. And I'm like, oh, are these Neanderthals? Like they
played...
Yeah, it's a bit, again, in the book, and there's many good reasons why you couldn't put this in the movie, because it would come across as like super racist and things. And it's sort of like, wait, so we're forgiving the Neanderthals and now they get a reservation or they get their own... Anyway, it's one of those things that the reason why they do it is sort of like the bare minimum of like, oh, we don't hunt the natives anymore, and we let them have their woods without going in there and hunting them like animals. And they're like, great, that's all we wanted. And like, oh, okay, like low bar to clear here. But yes, I don't know. It feels like in the future of Middle Earth, there's going to be lots of land acknowledgements in the future there. So the reason why these other men from the south and the east and stuff are all happy to come up and go up against Gondor and try and wipe out Gondor, even though they're not quite sure. They don't understand that Sauron is definitely the worst idea, or maybe they do, or whatever. Here's the thing. Gondor and the kings there, those high kings, they're Numenorians and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Bad news. Oh my goodness. Not great. Like the whole Return of the King. Mm. The kings back then, obviously not great kings. So totally self-aggrandizing, not caring about the normal folks and stuff. And it's very clear, especially when you get into in the Silmarillion, when they're retelling these Numenorian kings.
Yeah.
And what is it? The people who are the Rangers of the North and all these other people, these leftover remnants of these kingdoms, and down in Gondor is like the stewards. So they're not kings. They're like in the movie, there's like this little seat that's next to the throne. He doesn't get to sit in the main throne. He's like down at the bottom there and sitting on this little throne. So those leftover kings, awful people.
Yeah.
All of the black riders, the nine.
Yeah.
What do you call them? Oh, I've forgotten all the names now.
The amount of names. The
Nazgul. That's what I'm trying to say. It's been a while since I've read the books and looked at these notes. The Nazgul. They are all of these old kings from back in the day who Sauron gave rings to. All of those people. All of these people were long lived. One or the other. I don't know which one is correct in this way. And they all wanted to live longer. So there was this massive quest of immortality. Uh-huh. And everything back in the day was about how can we live longer? Mm. And as I was reading these books, like The Silmarillion, and then reading through The Lord of the Rings, and then the appendices to The Lord of the Rings, these other bits and pieces, I'm like, these are the worst, robber baron tech bro kind of people. That it's all about them. They're the most powerful. They've got literally everything. They are kings.
Yes.
They live longer than everyone. They've got more money and power than everyone.
But they want more of everything.
Everything that they want. But you know what they want? More of that.
Yeah.
And every bad decision that they do is gone down to sort of like, the power corrupts, but absolute power corrupts absolutely. Mm. It's just that. So and the whole of the world, it was destroyed when they literally took on the gods, and the whole of those West, all destroyed, cast into the sea, smashed up. Everyone, every time any of these kings gets slightly too much power, it's just bad news for
everybody suffers.
So here's the thing, in this whole book, it's like this book is like, oh man, these, and so the return of the king, the idea of, like, the hobbits will say, oh, not until the king returns will, you know, we do this, and it, but it's fallen out of it's nobody remembers why we say not until the king returns, you know.
Right.
It's like singing a nursery rhyme about London Bridge falling down. You're like, what? London Bridge? Oh no, that's Tower Bridge. This one's London Bridge. Like, why is it falling down? You know, it's this stuff lost to memory, which was like an expression from
everybody knew at that point, so it needed no explanation.
Yeah, and it just wasn't passed on. And now you're singing nursery rhymes about, like, the Black Death or some plagues, and you don't understand where it comes from. So it's hanging over the whole place, you know, hanging over the whole of Middle Earth, that the king will return. But for quite a lot of people, that's not a good thing.
Yeah.
And weirdly, at the end of this, they're like, oh, right, Aragorn has turned up, and now he's got himself an elf bride. Mm-hmm. So now their offspring are also going to be mortal, but a new receding of, you know, elf bloodline or elf light, you know, the light of the trees from the creation and things, is then going to be there. So their offspring is going to be longer lived than they are. And then, you know, depending on how many elf man crosses that you have in the future. But this seems to be very much clearly, this is the last one.
Yeah.
You know, because all the elves are sailing away and, you know, everyone's heading over to the west and, you know, leaving behind Middle Earth. So this is the last chance that we have of elven, you know, tree light, you know, light, the light of creation going forward. And I'm like, oh, I'm not quite into this. Hopefully they don't have any children, is what I'm thinking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, just
the struggle will continue.
How about we just end it here?
Yeah.
Like, Saruman doesn't have power anymore, is defeated, Sauron is gone, Gandalf is like, yeah, my job here is pretty much done, I'm gonna head back over to the west with the elves because I'm not needed, that there's no, we don't need any big power now to you know, equal out the power of Sauron, and, you know, the, because he's the last remnant of the power of Morgoth, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, from now on, like, the last of the dragons will probably die, you know, there might be a Balrog or two, but, you know, they're not going to be set, or whatever's going to happen, you know, whatever's happening now, we no longer need this. And I found it really strange that in the movie, elves were seen as sort of like good, bad, whatever. It kind of felt like they had to put some elves into Helm's Deep just to have any elf do anything heroic, which isn't just Legolas.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the movie and at the end of the book, they're like, and now a wedding between Aragorn and Arwen. And I'm like, everyone's like, yay. And there's a big celebration. I'm like, I think a lot more people there would be a lot more racist against the choice of the wife of the new king. We've never seen the king turn up. He's just turned up. We know he's a king because he can heal people and whatever, you know, that.
And he had the, like, the seal ring or something,
yeah,
didn't he? Like,
in the book, it's very clear that he can lay hands on people and heal them.
Oh, wow.
But only the king has that power. And because he has that power, he's
okay.
So
it's literally the, I pull the sword out of the thing.
It's sort of like, we set up the rules that if this, then that. If A equals B, so if B, then A.
And that
A.
person ticks all the boxes.
Yeah, they tick all the boxes. Mm. And it's shown as that kind of, as that kind of level. And I'm like, oh, man, this is, I don't know. It feels like there could, if you were going to go back and make another movie or another TV show, don't go back to the Rings of Power. Like, how about how, well, I guess now I'm just talking about the later Dune movies, sort of like, maybe this is the start of a despotic reign rather than good news that there's new elf light in the reigning system. Because I'm like, they're all going to be longer lived, and they're all going to be, you know, the next round is going to be like a whole new line of people who are craving immortality.
And then how long does it take for the first person to be so far away from from Aragorn that they then start thinking, oh, there's something better than everybody else.
And they're like,
else.
Hey, I'm going to make a ring which puts my power. And you're like, guys, stop it. Yeah. I mean, it'll, like I say, how epic the magic is like ramps off pretty sharply.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a quick drink and then I'll move on to my next note.
Take a drink. I can keep talking until you're good with your...
I think
your
I'm good.
Throat again.
So, because I'm trying to get through my notes pretty quick, because we're half what you said, or well, you want this to be just an hour long podcast rather than an hour and a half or whatever.
Yeah.
So, the good thing about book five, which is about men and kings, and what makes a good king and what makes a bad king, and what makes, because there's bad kings as well with, Denethor. And you get these like different things. You've got Theoden and Denethor. And one of them was kind of like subsumed under the power of Saruman and the other one of Sauron. And Denethor kind of throws off his shackles and becomes a great king again. Yeah. Denethor kind of goes in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Can I just, I know. I didn't want to have this too long, but I want to interrupt you because yesterday I read on Mastodon something about how somebody took some passages from when Denethor had the access to the Palantir.
Yes.
And he kept looking into it and he kept looking what was happening and he couldn't get rid of it. Like he couldn't stop like consuming what he was seeing.
Yeah.
Somebody took that as an analogy for what social media and the access in our phones to news is.
Oh, yeah.
Is absolutely that. Like you get
it's corrupting.
It's so corrupting. And I thought that was a really good analogy to our current times of how everybody has literally a Palantir in their hands and pockets.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Palantir is now the name of some big tech company.
Yes.
Set up by Peter Thiel. Have you heard about Peter Thiel?
Yes.
Talk about someone who is like drinking the blood of virgins to like get long lived.
Absolutely.
It's like he read Lord of the Rings and was sort of like, do I want to be like Aragorn, who is like the best king, or Theoden, or Éomer, or these other people who are like great people and friends with people and using their power for good and forgiveness and giving things away and kindness? Or should I be like the Numenorean kings of old and misunderstand what a Palantir is and think it's a good thing, which were created as tools? They were created by the men, like these powerful half-elven men, to be like, all right, this is going to be great.
Yeah, we can,
this is our
ansibles.
And the as almost immediately they're used for corruption and bad stuff, you know.
Yeah.
There's later on in the book, there's conversations between the orcs saying, oh, how do you already know this? It's sort of like, oh yeah, in this, and obviously in Minas Morgul is a Palantir and here is a Palantir. And there's, you know, there's meant to be seven, but there's like five of them which are like described in the book itself of like who's got this, and everyone who has one is corrupted by Saruman is corrupted by Sauron because he looks into the Palantir and starts trying to be like, oh wow, Sauron, he's got it going, like I want that kind of power. I can take that, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then this Peter Thiel sets up a company called Palantir. You're like, oh, so you want to, you're going to name your company after like one of the most insidious, corrupting forces and this piece of like what should be forbidden. You know, it's that meme sort of like, I have created the nihilism vortex. Because I thought creating the nihilism vortex was the message of the science fiction book. Mm-hmm. Please don't create the nihilism vortex. Not nihilism. What's the word?
Yes. But that's literally the thing. That
is it, don't
when you see like,
create the vortex. Let's see if it comes in here. Oh, torment nexus. Don't create the torment nexus.
Yes.
And it's sort of like...
Is that an XKCD?
No, it's a tweet from someone. I think this is maybe what it comes from. Let's see. Yeah, Alex Bleshman, sci-fi author. In my book, I invented the Torment Nexus as a cautionary tale. Tech company. Yeah. At long last, we have created the Torment Nexus from the classic sci-fi novel, Don't Create the Torment Nexus.
Yes. It's like somebody looking at Star Wars and then coming out with the idea that, oh yeah.
Death Star.
Amazing. Everybody wants Death Stars, no?
Oh, they're like, Dark Side.
Yeah.
Dark side of the anyway, that's what it is. So anyway, this is just what I wanted to, this is why I was saying, like, also coming back to like modern tech bro, like not tech bro, like tech mogul kind of things. It's sort of like, guys, Aragorn is the king who was the opposite all of that.
Yeah.
Than all of that. Yeah. He was like, it's not just return of the king, it's the return of like light, you know, the light side of the king. Mm-hmm. And so like, yeah, remember why everybody else is ganging up on Mordor and gang, no, not Mordor, ganging up on Gondor and ganging up on, you know, on the Riders of Rohan and things.
Yeah. There were reasons.
Yeah.
And again, not reasons you're striving for.
So anyway.
Yeah, sorry. I wanted to add that to the what's his, the king's name? Denethor?
Denethor.
Because that's literally something I just read yesterday.
Okay, good. Good stuff.
Mm.
It wasn't someone who was repairing aeroplanes, was it?
Why?
There's just a funny thing that comes across on Instagram sometimes.
The Boeing engineer thing.
Yeah, aircraft maintenance engineer.
And then at the end, he always had like, no.
And that's why it's okay that the windshield has an air bubble in it.
Yeah.
Talk about racism highborn. We did that in a previous episode when I was talking about how...
pure.
Yes. King's dying and being replaced. Happens in this book again. It's about like succession and how a king becomes a great king.
Yeah.
But also this book, which is about men, there's a few characters who are not men, and it's very, very, very either clearly or heavy-handedly or clunkily or cleverly, depending on how you want to look at it, by Tolkien is saying that not being a man is also. So the greatest heroes are not men. And it's very kind of biblical or Christian in this way, which is Jesus saying, you know, be kind to the meekest, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth. It's that kind of message.
Okay.
Of you don't just concentrate on the strong and powerful. Don't concentrate on the good and the great. The small people, the people who are marginalized, they have the same or greater value. And in this case, you have Merry, who is not a man, teaming up with Eowyn, who is not a man. Yeah. They both have to sneak away from the camp because they're like, women, stay back here. Hobbits, you're too small to go into battle. Stay back here.
Yeah.
And they pretty much, Eowyn dresses up as a man and hides Merry under her cloak and rides for 7 days into battle. Yeah. Meanwhile, all the other riders, you know, all the people she's riding with is going, they're like rolling her eyes and going, yeah, okay, Eowyn, you always were one, like, we're not gonna like dob you into your, you know, cousin and brother and uncle or whatever. So we'll let you come along. And they call Merry baggage because they don't acknowledge he's there, because all of those, you know, the people off in this other company, they all know that he's there, and they all know that Eowyn isn't a man and is riding here against the wishes of the king.
Right.
But they're all turning a blind eye to it. Anyway, they get into battle, and they're the one who kills the Lord of the Nazgul.
Yeah.
And the Witch King. And it's sort of like, no man shall hinder me. And they're both like, we're not men. Well, Eowyn is very clear that she's sort of like, she laughs and sort of like, I'm no man, I can hinder you.
Yeah.
And Merry is sort of like, yeah, back in the, like, remember in book one when we fell into a barrow and we like found some old swords? It turns out these were swords from like these Numenorean kings. Uh-huh. And this is your sword. Well, it's not your sword, but it's sort of like, this is the kind of sword which was forged back in the day when you were a man instead of this ring. Wraith and stuff, and they're like, stab you in the, you know, fun moment in the movie, sort of like, no man shall kill me, I am no man. It's sort of like, oh great, this is great. And it's
good job for pointing it out. There's obvious
and that's the thing in the movie, it's sort of like a kind of like, yay, you are no man, and it's sort of like, this is the one moment where, but it's not like, and it feels very clear in the movie that her job was to become the steward back home.
Yeah.
She's a bad leader because she isn't there. It's fortuitous that she's in the right place. But it was very clear that she was meant to be the leader back. And in the movie, it's much more like, oh yeah, go look after the women and children.
Yeah.
In the book, it's more like, no, you are now the leader back here. The army is gone, but we still need to run the country back there. Yeah. That's like a really important job.
Yes.
But I think in the book, it feels less of a feminist kind of like, yay, women can be...
women can be heroes
too. It's more like men should learn something from the less powerful.
Yeah.
That these people, just because they, you know, can't swing a sword quite as hard and aren't quite as tall and quite as, you know, like knights or kings or whatever, they're like the backup characters or whatever, like the supporting roles can be just as impactful and just as important. So again, I don't think it's a message about feminism. I think it's more of a the opposite of men, or the opposite of what it is to be a man, or people who are not men.
Yeah.
There's so much to learn from
them. As valuable,
yeah. Can do stuff that you can't do.
Yeah.
And even if their role is different, it's not lesser. And I think that's more of the point.
Yeah. Yeah.
That in, you know, with the Sam and Frodo relationship, that he's always sort of like, oh yeah, Frodo is my master. But when you actually get down to it, it's just sort of like, we've got two different jobs. Mm. Like, your job is to carry the responsibility and all the burden of, you know, in this case, the ring or whatever it's going to be.
Yeah.
Whatever job you need to be doing, you need to be doing that. And other people around you, it's their job to help you as much as possible and to support you as much as possible. And that's not a lesser job.
Absolutely.
That
not.
Is just the same amount of job. That's just the same amount of work. And it feels like the book is saying that, yeah, the people who are, you know, running things, is they
have people in the back that you don't see, but they're just as important.
Yeah, yeah. And book five makes that very clear. All right, let's move on to the what's this thing? Oh yeah, Weird How It Tries to Make Up for Colonialism, but I mentioned that before as well. Book six, Hobbits. We go back to the Hobbits.
Okay. Is that after all the battles?
All the battles go on and stuff, and they go up to the Black Gates, and then cliffhanger, something's going to happen, and then we skip back in time, and we have a battle. I think, no, the spider battle. They fought the spider. This is now back over to Sam and Frodo.
Yeah.
Going, this book starts as they kind of cross the border into Mordor.
Yeah.
So we skip back. And this is the point where they go, hey, just the time when Aragorn was coming up the river in these boats, this is where they are now in their journey. So everything is kind of like mismatched in time.
So it's not linear, and it jumps backwards and
forwards. Yeah, we jump back in time and we catch up at this cliffhanger of like, is everything doomed or is something going to be successful? And then we get the whole Hobbit stuff and more friendship thing. Don't need to talk too much about that, but it's much more about now what the hobbits have learnt on their journey. And it's very clear when you get to the end of the book that the book starts off and we have all of book one, this whole story, the whole Lord of the Rings starts off, but it's 100% hobbits.
Yes.
And then we get here and again it's 100% hobbits.
Yeah.
Even if other stuff's happening, you only ever hear about it if hobbits have seen
hobbits,
it.
Yeah.
That happens in the middle books as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is much more like Sam, Frodo, where are they up to? How far have they got up to? What are they doing now here? How are they getting on? And then when they get back, what's their recovery? And then they go back all the way back to the Shire. And when they get back to the Shire, they have Saruman is there.
Oh, really?
And Wormtongue, yes.
Oh.
Completely left out of the movie is like the whole point of the entire book. Which is the reason why we start in the Shire and the reason why the movie ends back in the Shire again.
Yeah.
Is because when they get back there, they have to, without using magic, defeat someone who used to be magic and now has lost all his magic. Saruman doesn't have magic anymore.
Okay.
All he has is his persuasion. Yeah. All he has is his charisma. And he has Wormtongue there. And he has been, over the years, like scoping out the Shire. I think because he likes tobacco, you know, whatever it is.
All right.
So he likes smoking.
He's an investor coming in.
Yeah. Well, no. It's much more about like, hey, if we all band together, we can defeat the colonial power. Whatever.
Right.
Whatever. Again, it doesn't. What the situation is isn't that important.
Yeah.
But the important part is that the four hobbits get home. Merry and Pippin have drunken Ent wine or Ent water, whatever it is, and they're now taller. And now they look really regal on their horses coming in. And they come back and like, holy shit, this is the return of the king. Merry and Pippin are going to solve all our problems. And all of the hobbits have defeated a big bad.
Yeah.
Okay. We had Merry defeating the Witch King with Eowyn.
Yeah.
Sam has killed the spider.
Yes.
Frodo has fucking killed the biggest bad. Pippin has been involved in a battle. He stabbed a troll and then someone fell.
Yeah, he was with with what's his name?
He went up to the Black Gates with Aragorn at that point. The hobbits have been spread out and done different.
Yeah, that's in the movies as
different
well.
Bits and pieces.
Yeah.
But they come back, and what they have learned is friendship, leadership.
Yeah.
Kindness. Mm-hmm. At one point they say, all right, we've got to defeat Saruman, and he's got like the tall, like big people, like humans, men have come in, and they're like taking everything down, and the whole Shire is being turned into this industrial wasteland. They've chopped down all the trees and they're mining stuff out, and they're taxing everyone like 100% of the stuff and trying to give stuff out. Redistribution, they call it. It seems, again, this was written in 1940s up to 1950s. This seems cautionary tale against like
industrial,
not just industrialization, but also like the, you know, like totalitarianism and things. And this is about like, hey, if we all get together, but it does, is we all get together and learn the lessons that these hobbits have learned in the last year, 2 years that they've been off and growing taller and defeating legendary enemies. At one point Frodo says, hey, we're going to take over here, even though there are hobbits on the other side, even though some of the sheriffs are now on the other side. We don't kill any hobbit, because again, it's very clear that no hobbit has ever murdered or killed another hobbit.
Yeah.
And all of the lessons that they've learned from being around kings, all of the lessons that they've learned from going on the whole journey, all of that pays off in this final chapter, or this second to last chapter.
The
movie should have either ended the moment the ring gets thrown in and the tower blows up and the eye winks out
would
and everyone like
great ending
that. maybe like get the whole fellowship back together again, you know, they come in and everyone's like, Frodo is like, oh, here, weirdly enough in the book, all told from Sam's point of view, again, Sam is the point of view character for the whole of this last section here,
right?
All of the time that they're slogging through Mordor, and Frodo is like this, and feeling bad for himself. That's all from Sam's point of view here. It's so much about, you know, the Sam and his growth and what he's thinking and he's doing.
Yeah.
Frodo is a minor character in the end of this.
Yeah.
In this Mordor section, and also in the movie they have Frodo make a choice between Gollum and Sam.
Yeah.
Never made sense to me in the movie. And doesn't make sense at all in the book. Is completely missing. You know, Gollum's hardly in at this point. You know, he turns up a few little times at the end and right at the very end. But there isn't like this long extended bit where, you know, Gollum is going to betray them. And it doesn't make any sense. And
I again, think that kind of has something to do with the movies and Andy Serkis. Yeah. And like they had to include it.
They had to have some drama in there. Yeah. Otherwise, there's no drama, because the drama is, wow, this is a slog.
Yeah.
Getting in there is tricky. So anyway, this is left over from the movie. They get back to the Shire, and the four of them sit down and start drinking. And the entire end of the movie is the opposite of what it is in the book, which is they sit down, look around, and go, "Well, nothing's changed here." And everyone looks at them and go, "Oh yeah, there's those four drinking. They're not heroes." None of the lessons that they learned along the way is that important. They write a book, but who would care about the book? Because they didn't come back and demonstrate their heroicness and demonstrate their leadership and demonstrate their, I say leadership, it's very basic. It's sort of like, you know, the hobbits are so dim that they just needed to have like one person go, you know, we can just not run away. We can just, you know, we're pretty good with bows and arrows and we're pretty sneaky. So yeah, it's just weird that the movie has like the opposite lessons learned.
Yeah, they didn't have time and resources anymore by that point.
Well, yeah.
It was super long.
The lesson is, if you're already powerful, great. Yeah. You just need to own up to the fact that you need to be responsible.
Yeah.
And then if you're not very powerful, sure, whatever, just go sit in the pub and keep quiet and nobody will notice you, and that's probably the best outcome.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, really? Oh, that's a pity. Again, that was even at the time when I watched the movie the first time, back in 2003, whenever it was that I watched that movie for the first time. And then from then on, I was sort of like, yeah, there's this, it's this book is from like, you know, all of this stuff was like war experiences from the First World War, Second World War, politics of the time, both good and bad, grappling with colonialism, grappling with the totalitarian, grappling with authoritarianism, grappling with forgiveness, all of this different kind kind of stuff which is in the air from, let's say, the 1920s through to the 1950s when this was all being written.
Yeah.
In the movie, it's sort of like 9/11 something something whatever.
Yeah.
Like it's again, I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I actually do think the last movie is bad, but this isn't one of the reasons.
Yeah.
They had to tell some story that fits in with the modern politics. But the reading through this now makes me feel so much more that this is a book from its time and grappling with its issues. And I totally understand why people say, oh, it's an analogy for World War II, or it's an analogy for this, even though Tolkien is saying it's not an analogy, you know, in these extra introductions and, you know, letters to the editor. He's all like, no, I don't like analogy.
Yeah.
I'm going to write something that's rich, which is so rich and so complex and so feels real to itself and is true to itself, that if people want to find messages about the Second World War or totalitarianism or good or forgiveness or colonialism or sexism,
you can find
imperialism,
it all in it.
Of course it's all in there, because he's creating something which is trying to reflect how rich and complex the world is, that we do have to worry about, you know, indigenous people in different areas. But also, we've got to win a war. And also, why are we fighting this war? And also, what's the best solution? You know, all of this different kind of stuff. It's trying to be as rich and as complex as life itself and as history itself and language itself and culture and all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
So if you read this book and go, wow, it's pretty racist, it's sort of like, yeah, the world is racist. And if you're reflecting the world, especially in the 1930s to 1950s when this book was written, that's going to be there.
Yeah.
And it's, even if the message is kindness, forgiveness, trying to right past wrongs, land acknowledgements, letting people have their homes, for, you know, all of the stuff that this book is for, people say, oh yeah, but the bad guys are from the South, so it must be racist. It's all like, ah, oh, kind of missing the point, which you can totally get by watching the movies.
Yeah.
And you can totally get by even like reading this book and not reading the appendices, or not reading the
You kind of need to read all of it
and
to get the full picture.
That's what this Meal of Thorns podcast was talking about. And I listened to that after reading this the Silmarillion, but not having continued on. He's saying the Silmarillion problematizes the racism which is in the first level reading or even watching of the movie of The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Because all of this stuff that's there, which is like, these are people grappling with how the world is and how the world used to be more powerful.
Mm.
And now we are less powerful, but we're still having to literally live in the ruins of past empires and trying to sort out the problems of past evil. Like, if you think Sauron and Saruman are bad, think about Morgoth and these other people from back in the day, Melkor, whatever his name was, like that was bad news. The solution to the problem back then was literally flood the world and start again from scratch, or flood the world and just fuck it. It was change the shape of the world so it's no longer a disc where you can sail here to this other island. We're going to break the geometry of the world, turn it into a globe. So when people sail west to try and invade the, you know, the Undying Lands, they go all the way around and arrive back on the other side again. They're sort of like, you know, Atlantis erasure, sort of like, nope, we're taking, like, that was, it used to be really, really bad. Like, stuff used, like, when it was bad, it used to be really, really bad.
Yeah.
And now when it's bad, it's like, we can defeat it with some battles and, like, destroying this ring, you know. It's quite clear that in the book, that these big battles are like existential crises, not for the men or for the Gondor or these other kind of things. I mean, it's bad news, but really it's Sauron and Saruman doing these last gasp efforts of like, oh shit, I've got to press the advantage now, otherwise we're fucked. And guess what? They're fucked. You know, it didn't work out. Again, it's quite precarious on both sides.
Yeah.
But there isn't, you know, it's like these big ancient powers trying to survive in the world, and this is their last defeat. And you know, that's what creates like this, the fourth age, which is the age of men,
right?
The age of man or men, either way. Yes, let's wrap it up there in terms of the story and the and the book.
I really like the idea that in this Lord of the Rings epic. And now I'm saying like literally not just the one book, but all the things around it, like the Silmarillion, the appendices and the whole world that was being built, that it is showing the complexity and the messiness, and that you can't just solve it by, oh, we just do this or that. And also it shows how, like, when you have one big evil, one big really bad thing, and you just like chop it up into different smaller evils, it doesn't get easier.
No.
It just gets more complex, which is then even more difficult to stitch back together in a way.
Yeah.
To do the right thing, because there's like from whatever angle you look at it.
Yeah.
The right thing that you think is the right thing can be completely the opposite.
Yeah. And that is, that's kind of, again, that's what the book is about. Mm. It's about lots of small people, literally in terms of hobbits, but also other people trying to do the right thing in every situation.
Yeah.
And that is so different than a fantasy novel, which is about powerful people defeating, like, by force of magic or force of will, or who's got the bigger army, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
All of the bigger army things are much more like a reflection or a sideshow, not even a sideshow, but like they are signals of the people doing the right thing, even if it's difficult.
Yeah.
The difficult thing, the bad thing, no, let me put it this way. The right thing is to get 7,000 or 9,000 people and take them up on, like, maybe a suicide mission to the Black Gate.
Mm.
That's something that is, like, everybody along there knows that this is this could have a really bad outcome.
Yeah.
But we really need to draw the Eye of Sauron in this direction, and the forces of Sauron, we need to get them there. We need to get them contained up there, because that's the most important thing. You know, so Aragorn talks into his Palantir and is sort of like, hey, Sauron, I'm coming for you. Meet you at the Black Gates. And they're like, all right. And so all of the forces drain out of the whole of Mordor, and they all go up towards the Black Gate.
Yeah, to show the importance.
Yeah.
Like, they needed to show this importance.
But all of that was to help Sam and Frodo get across Mordor.
Like, just imagine, he would have said, yes, let's do this. And then a handful of people would have said, yes, we're coming with you.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have been convincing at all.
So yes. Lord of the Rings is if I want to bring out the themes, it's those themes. And it's pretty incredible that the legacy of Lord of the Rings is like an entire genre of fantasy where it feels like a lot of it is like, oh, being the chosen one is great, going on a quest is great, you know, magical MacGuffins is great, you know, all of these different kind of things where it's sort of like, ah, yeah, but you need a core, you need a heart to the novel. And it's okay if it's not that same thing, but what is at the heart of it? You know what I mean? Like, I read the R. Scott Bakker Prince of Nothing series.
Yeah.
And that's reflecting, that's in dialogue with Lord of the Rings a lot. You know, they have their elven people and those are weirder people.
Yeah.
And they have their slogs. They have their, like, one book is sort of like, all right, we're just going to do the Mines of Moria. Okay, let's go into this thing and we're going to go for 3 weeks underground here.
Yeah.
And they have their slog of slogs, and they also have their lembus bread, you know, the kind
bread
of thing. But it's just meth. It's just speed, you know.
Right.
It's sort of like they're just taking it and, you know, a lot of that. But the message in that book is kind of like the opposite in that way. It's very like Machiavellian, and the people who are meant to be the heroes and you're following along, you're like, wait, they're defeating an evil but by the opposite of kindness and the opposite of friendship and things. It's a very strange book, but again, at the heart of it is someone who understands that, all right, this is going to be the siege book, right? I'm going to do Constantinople siege better than anyone has ever done it before, right? And I'm going to now do, this is going to be about the other side of it, this is going to be about the crusade that goes over there. So very clever writing in the opposite direction. When you actually go back and read it, you go, right, this R. Scott Bakker at every point was taking the opposite view of, not the opposite view, but the heart of it is like, what is man, and what is man good at? Is that, all right, is it friendship, and is it kindness, and is it forgiveness? It could be something a little bit more nihilistic than that.
Yeah.
Anyway, you said you wanted this podcast to last an hour.
Yeah.
I've got to the end of my notes, but what I actually wanted to do was review the book.
Okay.
So far, I've talked about hobbits, I've talked about elves, I've talked about wizards, I've talked about men, I've talked about dwarves.
And kings.
And kings and all of this kind of stuff. And I've talked about what the book's about. But is it a good book? And I've already kind of given away in that first episode when I gave the rating of it all. What was it, 4 stars or 4.5 stars? I can't remember what it was.
Like, yeah.
I think it was 4.5 stars. It's generally my reading experience of The Lord of the Rings this time. And the reason why it doesn't get 5 stars is, and I'm not kidding, partly Andy Serkis is so bad at singing, and there's quite a lot of singing in this book, and he ruined it for me. I wish he'd have just done...
Such a pity, because...
I wish he'd have just done... Like, I wish he'd have just read the poetry as poetry rather than trying to sing it. Yeah. So bad. So every time he started singing...
Oh, please don't do it.
No, I'm not going to do it. Okay. I'd pause it and then go and find the poem, and if it was short, read it myself, or if it was a bit longer, I'd be like, oh, here's a YouTube video of somebody actually singing it, and I could read along and do it like that. Mm. Oh my goodness, what a baller. And then I was driving, and I was like, I can't do that when I'm driving. So I was driving along, and he started singing, and it was so bad, and I was like, well, I've got to listen to it if I want to. I just literally just got my phone, you know, like you do in driving mode. It's sort of like there's these big, like, skip forward 30 seconds thing. Skip, 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 skip. I just missed that part, and I just didn't go back and listen to it. Right. Like, I didn't go back and read it, didn't go back and listen to it. Huh. It was his reading was so good. All of the voices were so good. I mentioned previously that he does the impressions, or he does versions of the actors' versions of the characters.
Yes.
All really good, but the singing so bad.
Now I have a question.
Oh, yeah, question.
You are now reducing the amount of your appreciation of this book by something very specific in the audiobook.
Yeah, but I can't review it.
In the past, you have said that you can listen over like AI voices, what they are doing, and like get over it and still go to the content.
I know the point you're making.
Is this like a fair rating now to the Lord of the Rings book?
There are authors, there are narrators who do a good job. Mm. There's narrators who do a medium job, or like average job. They don't get in the way. They're not adding anything to the text, but I'm still getting all of the text. There's some narrators who do a bad job, and that's where it gets tricky for me, that I'm now having to listen to the words that are that are being said, translate them into like words on a page, or like remove all the emotion and performance that they're doing. The audiobook that I'm listening to now has that a bit where I'm like, okay, they're doing a voice of this alien in this voice, but there was nothing in the text to say that that's what the voice should sound like.
Right.
So I'm now going to decode that voice and then put it back into language and then reimagine that voice in my head. And I'm very good at that. And then there's a level of Andy Serkis singing and other people and other audiobooks where it's so bad, I can't do that because what they're doing is so bad, I can't bring myself to listen to the words.
I get that.
Even if they're playing and I didn't press pause or skip forward, I can't, the words don't enter my brain because it's too difficult.
I understand.
It is fair for me to critique a listening experience or reading experience because of this.
This is not what I'm saying. It is completely fair for you to say that. What I'm saying is that J.R.R. Tolkien and his son have given out a written piece of storytelling.
Yeah, I'm not reviewing that.
Okay.
I'm reviewing my reading experience of this time reading the book, which comes after watching the movies, which comes by listening to the audiobook.
Okay.
It comes not having the physical book in my hands and having to turn pages and fall asleep and lose my place and having to have a light
and having
shining
it fall
down
on your face.
And also positively being able to flick back and see the maps in the front, or being able to see the spelling of the words and not having to do it. But then also, I liked when listening to Silmarillion not having to decode all those words and work out which are the characters who are important or not in this massive morass. So I'm like, oh yeah, I don't have to decode all of that.
Yeah.
Someone's done it for me, and I'll just, when I hear that name again, be like, oh right, they're important because I've heard their name more than once. You know, I'm reviewing my experience. Also, even if Andy Serkis was a fantastic singer, if you just read it, there are things about the book itself which I think don't hold up so well and would be done slightly different. And that is the pacing of this book. Not switching backwards and forwards between the chapters on a chapter by chapter, but like, here is 1/6 of the entire novel and we're just going to spend it with these two people or this collection of people, and we're going to abandon the other people. You know, like these middle three books where you have, you know, the Ents and the Wizards and Helm's Deep, And then you have, you know, I'm just saying, it switches back in a way, which I realize why modern authors don't do that. When they're doing the epic fantasies, they have a big chunk with one point of view character, and then they go over and fill you in a bit over here.
Yeah.
I think this isn't the best framework for humans to enjoy the stories, because humans pretty much do things on around about 45-minute cycles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we're watching a movie, there'll be that point where we press pause and we go for a wee, and it's almost exactly 42 to 43 minutes in, because that is just the pacing of, you've had the intro, big rising action, this is the place where there's the first lull in action. And when you're listening to a podcast, this podcast of being an hour and 4 minutes isn't great. It should either be 45 minutes or it should be an hour and a half.
Yeah.
This is kind of a cycle that you go through, you know, in sports, you know, like everything, you know, the first half is 45 minutes,
everyone
takes a break, you know, keeping going longer than that. So when you get into an audiobook and you're like, oh, right, so I've got like 12 hours to go, or like 7 hours or whatever it is, before I get back to those characters that I was just spending time with. It, again, pacing isn't done that well. But here's the other thing, is at the start of this book, we don't have any other characters. We just have Frodo, and it's all from Frodo's point of view, and then, you know, Sam and Pippin and other people. And that is too long at the start.
Okay.
It's sort of like, well, we've got to give them something to do. All right, how long is it going to take them to get out of Hobbiton?
Yeah.
A long time. How long is it going to take them to get across this farmer's field? Even longer. How long is it going to take to get like across here, and they're going to meet the relatives? Even longer. They're going to get across the river. It's taking a long time. They've got to get through this forest. Even longer. Got to get away from Tom Bombadil, who shouldn't even be in the book. Takes even longer. Get across these barrows, and again, then they're going to meet the horses. They're going to do this. It just takes them ages and ages and ages to get to the Council of Elders, to get to Rivendell.
Yeah. But that gives it like the severity of how long it actually takes.
Yeah.
Like it gives it like each some gravitas.
Each one of the things that the hobbits are trying to solve, in other words, there might be some dogs over there, or, you know, we've got to get across this farmer's field without being spotted, is them growing into their adventurous stuff and needing help at the start and not needing help at the end.
Mm.
It is it just takes too long.
Mm.
It, honestly, again, in the movie, they're like, oh, we just got to compress this, because we really got to get to the Council of Elrond. We got to get to Rivendell and actually lay out what's at stake and what the plan is for the rest of this whole book.
Yeah.
And 1/6 of the entire book before we actually know what the plan is, or like what we're trying to do in the rest of the book, is a bit long.
Right.
And then at the end of the book, we have another thing. We have the opposite problem, where it takes them just a long time to get back to Hobbiton.
Mm.
You know, it takes them a long time to get back to the Shire again at the end.
Yeah. When literally they have friends that can take them onto the back of, like, what is it, eagles, and then fly them across.
Again, in the novel, it's made a lot more clear that the eagles, they're off doing their own thing. They're their own race. They're not, like, just big birds, intelligent birds. They're like the tree people or the elves, and, you know, they're at the same level as men.
Mm.
So either way, it's a different setup. It's a different kind of thing. So yeah, the pacing in the novel, there's just sometimes a bit too long, and I don't mind any like the long slogs where they're trying to get across the pools of death, or they're trying to get across here. I liked all of that. It's just sort of like, wow, that was the longest slog in this book is them getting from the edge of Hobbiton to Rivendell.
Yeah.
Like five to six adventures in that point.
All right.
All of them could have probably been accomplished with two.
Yeah. And here at that point...
Which is what they did in the movie, by the way.
Yes. You know. Where they had to, because, you know, time and energy. So is that when you said in The Silmarillion you really liked it, that Christopher Tolkien did the editing of it? And would you have like...
That was a different kind of thing.
Okay. So you couldn't just apply saying like, oh, if there would have been a bit more editing and...
In The Silmarillion, the longest section that you're ever really in the weeds of a topic is about an hour, 2 hours of the audiobook.
Right.
And the longest time that you're ever in this like really zoomed out, like chronological, biblical, and then this person begat that, and then this person did
that,
this, but this person did this, all of that kind of stuff.
Mm.
The longest you're ever in that, like an hour and a half, and then you go, right, let's get into some like elf adventures, or let's get into some, you know, someone coming along and killing a dragon, or whatever it's going to be.
Yeah.
It does this really great zooming in and zooming out kind of thing, way better paced than the Bible, because it's someone who's had existing material and said, let's put this together in a way which kind of makes sense. And The Silmarillion, because it's edited, it was a 5-star reading experience, because it was, again, also it was all new to me and really interesting. But yeah, uh, it this book is someone, again, I wouldn't say it needed an editor. I think in that case, when I said Christopher Tolkien should edit out Tom Bombadil, I was like, it's because what he was trying to do was take all this disparate material and make it like an internally consistent history mm-hmm. with not a lot of contradictions. So he would choose the versions of the stories. There was like four different versions of this chapter of the Silmarillion or this right. sub-story of the Silmarillion. He would pick out the one which had the fewest contradictions to the rest of it. Like the magic worked the same, the elves had the same characters, they mm-hmm. were doing things for the right reasons.
Yeah.
By that time, he had thought of the rings, so he's going to pay off some ring stuff later. You know, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. Yeah, and I wouldn't say this book needs editing down. I'm just saying it shows its age in terms of its pacing.
Right, yeah.
And obviously, Tolkien wasn't quite sure what the novel was going to be at the start. Mm. And the first section feels like, hey, you like The Hobbit, everyone. You want The Hobbit. All right, here's some more of The Hobbit.
Yeah.
Here's some more of the... And you start reading the book and like, great, this is like children's, like young adult, whatever, going on an adventure. And then the first thing which comes as sort of like, hey, we're like Boy Scouts and going across and we need to learn how to use a knife. And then we fall in a hole and we can dig ourselves out. You know, yeah. all of that kind of stuff. As you go along, it becomes more epic and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Grimmer.
And not just grimmer, but just sort of like more meaningful. It starts right. off with, it's like a, and this is what Dungeons and Dragons do with their campaign. You start off at level one or two or low level, and you're fighting kobolds and you're fighting, you know, little things. And the adventures are sort of like, how do we get a rope up there? And the idea is by the end of it, you're commanding armies. Because Dungeons and Dragons was... he had these war game things, you know, like these like large scale armies that you'd move around.
Like tin figures.
Yeah, like tin figures, but also like paper and, you know, like the Warhammer, you know, you got these models or whatever.
Yeah.
And the whole idea was like Dungeons and Dragons was the storytelling bit to work out why you're fighting and how you got the resources and how you built your, you know, how you got the money to pay for this big army that you do. And it turns out the narrative stuff is what people like rather than having to get rulers out and go, well, your people are like 72... 70 meters away, but my thing can only shoot this, and then there's a damage area. You know, all of like the nerdy wargaming stuff.
Yeah,
it's Dungeons and Dragons was the idea of like what's the who are our heroes? Who's commanding this army, or who's in this army?
Yeah,
who
but
are
it's,
those?
It's more the focus on the storytelling rather than the true life nerdy whatever.
Yeah. And so when you realize what's going on here, Lord of the Rings is setting the mold for all Dungeons and Dragons. Start off and you're like halflings and there's elves and this other kind of stuff around, but also like the like as you go up.
And the experience
by the
points.
End, I found a sword and that can kill the Witch King, but only if this person rolls a 20, this other person didn't do it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
All of Dungeons and Dragons is in here, including like leveling up. But I already know what the levels are going to be at the end. I know nobody wants to, like, if your character dies and you re-roll a character, nobody ever wants to start at level one again. Everybody goes, right, let's just start at level 10. Like, we don't die immediately when an orc sneezes. You know, we've already got a bag of holding. We don't have to refine that. You know, re-roll a character who's already at level 10 or whatever.
Yeah.
Or like four, whatever your character died at, just go down like four levels and then so you can have another ramp up to it. You know, that's what you want to do. And here it just felt like, oh man, I'm down at level one of Dungeons and Dragons, which is fun if the first time you do it. But, you know, after your first few games in Dungeons and Dragons, you don't want to be like bitten by a rat and die. You want to be like, no, what? I shouldn't have to worry about rats.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my review. Four and a half stars for being really, really fun. Lots of really good adventure, friendship, kindness, all of the good stuff in here. The racism is no worse than any other racism that I read, even in modern science fiction and fantasy. So I'm not going to ding it for that. The politics is probably as best as it could be in the 1950s. And let down a bit by the pacing and Andy Serkis's bad singing. They combine to knock it down from 5 stars to 4.5 star reading experience.
Okay.
That's it. That's my review.
Are we ever going to come back to these novels?
I'm definitely going to reread The Silmarillion at some point.
In another 20 years' time?
No, probably more. Here's the thing. When I get a book, which is a 5-star book, generally within 6 months to a year, I'll test it out again.
Whoa. Okay. This quick.
Yeah.
I mean, this soon.
Well, not even just 5-star books, but books which I feel like are really interesting. Piranesi, I read it. And then I was like, hey, you should read this and we'll review it.
Yeah.
while you're reading it, I just reread the whole thing. I mean, it helps that it's a kind of short and very well-read audiobook that I can just get through in like 6 hours or whatever it is.
Do these books then become
the Light
like
Brigade,
your...
Brigade, I did it.
They are like your comfort read that you can then go back and know that you're probably going to still like it?
If I give a book 5 stars, I know that there's enough in there that I'll get more out of, I'll get as much out of it on the second read.
Right.
And also not just 5 stars. There was the... what is it, the Delaney book as well, which I finished and was like, hey, I'll just go back. Was it the Einstein Intersection? Whatever, whichever the book was, but I finished it and was like, oh, I'll go back and do that one. Theodore Sturgeon, More Than Human. I was like, hey, I'll just reread this bit. And then I like reread it in the order that I thought I should have read it. And I was like, oh yeah, there's more. Again, these are not all 5-star books.
Yeah.
But if a book is short enough, if it's like, also weirdly, if it's like a fix-up novel or like an interesting take on a form, and I'm like, ah, let me see if I can get this, and like, now I know where the cracks are, or now I know where the joins are.
Yeah, you can
like,
concentrate on
other
things.
Yeah, I can concentrate on different things.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
And I think The Silmarillion for me is definitely a book. There's enough in there that if I start it again, I already know which names are the important ones that when they're mentioned for the first time, I'm like, oh, this is going to be important. Let's really like not just let this wash over me, but let's dig down into this.
Yeah, well, I'm still reading some parts of The Silmarillion, and I
just don't think it's a book for you.
Oh my god, the names, it's like name dropping here and there, and it's I mean, you said for me to skip some things, and I think I skipped the wrong things because I'm right in with the names here and this name and that name, and then they
are the
all
bits
really
that you shouldn't be reading.
Similar.
Here's the thing, should probably again, I listen to the audiobook, so it's a bit difficult, but it would be one of those things where I should say, read this chapter, read this section, look at this picture online, watch this YouTube video, and then read Beren and Luthien, and then read the Children of whatever the other guy is. I can't even remember now.
But then I have this...
Children
like,
of Beren.
I should read all this to...
No, you shouldn't.
...that I have gotten through everything and like have... You know, it's always like this kind of thought in my head that if I haven't read a book as a whole thing and I haven't come to my own conclusions, I feel like I've then failed.
It's not a failure.
The book.
Life is short.
Yes. I just need to find a good, catchy book that I can read. Currently, this is just in my library, and that's the book I open every night. All right.
Readers all the Goodreads now, a Goodreads section. Readers also enjoyed A Clash of Kings by George R. R. Martin, Dune by Frank Herbert, Harry Potter, and Feast for Crows. Oh, another George R. Oh, I think actually, you know what I was saying about an entire book is too long to like leave some characters? I think in the Game of Thrones or Ice and Fire, Book of Ice and Fire, Tale of Ice and Fire, whatever it is, that now is just called Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
At one point, an entire book, they're like, oh, that something's happening over there. Let's go. Let's just concentrate on these three characters or two characters over here, and then we'll go back. And people were like, hey, you normally switch chapters and go between these characters, and these characters were missing from this entire book. Again, I'm remembering back 20, 30 years from when these books were coming out.
So now you're on Goodreads for The Return of the King.
Yeah, 4.58 stars. So pretty high up
pretty
there.
Pretty good.
The movie, by far the worst movie, the book, pretty good compared to the other three of the three main books as you talk about it. Mario, Diva, Diane, Julie, Paul, Ryan, Ned, Helder, all of these 5-star reviews. Helton gives it 4 stars. Troy G gives it 2 stars. I didn't read my Tolkien until I had first read near 100 fantasy novels. Many of these take inspiration from Tolkien. Many of them did many of the things Tolkien does only better. I understand why this novel is venerated in such a great way that many I prefer are not. I don't have a problem with it, but I'll stick to my more modern books. Yeah, I totally understand
that
view. That.
Yep.
But here's the thing. I think that the language and the writing of Tolkien is on par with any modern fantasy I've ever read. And by modern fantasy, I mean anything written from like the 1970s onward, which is like the fantasy that I was reading as a kid.
Yeah.
And
but I understand that point of view, and I can agree in many ways.
Yep. So lots of people there enjoyed it. Community reviews, lots of 5-star reviews here. Yeah, this it tails
it's
off.
It's an
like
interesting
this.
Curve.
Yeah, so if you want to be my friends on Goodreads, I suggest you do, because then I can see what you think of Lord of the Rings and other books. Again, a lot of people's reviews will maybe be for the whole of the Lord, like the single volume edition.
Yeah.
So yeah, and you can also become my friend. I'll also go over to the community, SFBRP listener group on the community section of Goodreads, and you can recommend books for us to read, give episode feedback, and chat with other people. Not very many people do that. There's not like, it's not like, oh, you've got to keep up with like a massive forum or a Discord where you got to keep up with channels and otherwise you don't. No. It's like a few messages per month or whatever it works out. If you want like 20 or 30 things, paragraphs to read per year, that's probably good enough for you. All right. I'll leave you with, what's this? I invented the Torment Nexus. Don't create the Torment Nexus. I'm just closing some tabs here. Audiobooks. Look, let me just see if anyone talks about his singing in this one.
Probably.
No
singing.
Nobody mentions it. Well, I think more of the singing is in the earlier books. So Lord of the Rings. So most people his can't be Andy Serkis' performance cannot be praised enough. Yes. Andy Serkis is the best choice for narration. I can't believe nobody here mentions his bad singing. Other people did, though, so it's not just me.
No.
All right, what book are you reading now? You say you got The Silmarillion. What else are you reading? Oh, there's another fantasy book you read.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Maybe we'll do an episode on that this week or next week.
On my rehabilitation, I did have, you know, The Silmarillion on my ebook, and I thought, yes, that's the perfect time for me to read.
Absolutely not.
Turns out, no, absolutely not. So what I needed was an easygoing young adult-ish book.
We'll do the review. Just tell us what it is.
The recipe...
The Practical Guide to Wizardry Baking.
No, how to...
The Wizard's Guide to Practical Baking.
Yes, the Wizard's...
No, the Practical Guide to Offensive Baking.
Defensive Baking, yeah. Something like that.
Something like that. And you don't even remember the author. Well done, us. Well done, us. I queued you up to tell me the name of the book, thinking it'd be really fun.
So clever.
Already dropped out of your head.
Anyway, there's not a lot to talk about. And I think that for me, the conclusion to this book is kind of in the afterword of the author.
Yeah.
Themselves. There it is. A Wizard's Guide to Defensive Baking.
Yes, a young adult fantasy. Anyway, we're going to talk about fantasy in an upcoming episode.
And that's what I read.
The book I'm reading at the moment is called Some Desperate Glory by...
So you are also not prepared.
Yeah, Emily Tesh, I think it is. Won the Hugo Award last year, and it's been on my list of things I want to read. So
that's in my library reading to hold, like in a few weeks' time, I will have access to this book.
Well, maybe if you read it, well, maybe I'll save the review and we can discuss it together. Mm. Either way, I'm most of the way through it.
Okay.
It's really, I understand why it won the Hugo Award, and it's not bad.
Well, at least some books you don't understand why it wins awards at all. So good.
Oh, yeah,
Let's talk about that when we talk in this.
No, I just want to say I gave up on the Terraformers. So if you want to see my review of the Annalie Nevitz book, The Terraformers, I guess it's on Goodreads. I'm not going to talk about it. The book was so bad that it's not worth talking about. But there was an episode where they mentioned it on the Meal of Thorns episode. Oh.
So go there, listen to what they're saying.
Yeah, in that case, Jake, I'm on Jake's book. He got through to the end of the book. I don't know how, because he was struggling to find good things to say about that book. he kind of talked about things that I didn't like about it too. Cool. But I gave up after four chapters or eight chapters.
It happens. You just said it. Life is too short to get through a slog of a book.
This podcast was meant to be an hour long. What do you think we're up to?
An hour and 20 minutes.
An hour and 22 minutes.
See.
That's it from us. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.